now our feature presentation.
Welcome to the Movie Goings Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Wheeler.
And I'm your co-host, Michael Wheeler.
Today we will be talking about Terry Gilliam's Brazil from 1985.
Which has nothing to do with the World Cup.
Yes. Well, we just, you know, couldn't get enough of the World Cup, so
seemed appropriate.
Talking about Brazil seemed like the closest we could get, because I don't like sports movies.
Right, yeah. Although,
anyway,
this film, actually, I was about to say something about success, but it actually wasn't hugely successful.
Quite the opposite, really. Much like
Brazil's recent run in the World Cup, actually.
Oh, low blow.
Too soon?
Way too soon.
Okay.
Anyway, this was my pick, so you go ahead.
Yeah, so this film deals essentially with, it's set in a dystopian, although rather fantastical dystopian world, and it's about essentially a bureaucrat who wants to lay low and yet also dreams of heroics, and specifically of finding and saving a damsel in distress, and finds himself at odds with the very system that he has been working most of his life to protect and really to just be a part of. So this is a Terry Gilliam film. It's from 1985, and I'm not the biggest fan of Terry Gilliam. I don't
Let's not understate now.
Okay, I really struggled.
You're not a fan at all, right? I mean,
right. I haven't seen any of his other films all the way through. So if you are a Terry Gilliam fan out there, you're probably just dismissing everything that I have to say right now. But
there aren't enough of them probably to worry about whether they're doing that, first of all. And secondly,
okay,
I think I would hope that Terry Gilliam fans, speaking as one, would recognize that this is not everyone's cup of tea.
Right.
And just be used
to that. Yeah, it's not the most accessible style of filmmaking, that's for sure. But I can't help but admit, I mean, it's done very well. I think it was very effective, this particular film. But throughout, I honestly, I don't know, maybe this is just me, but I often find myself thinking in films that I really enjoy and that I like. Like, I think of all the people that I want to tell about it, or, you know, want to enjoy watching the film with again. And I did not think about that at all as I was watching this. I was thinking, oh, I was sort of running through the list of people who I generally watch movies with. And I was like, yeah, nope.
You need better friends. I mean, sorry, Micah's friends, but
they don't listen to this anyway. So,
good. Well, there you go. Yeah, so you do need better friends.
Maybe so. So it took a lot of time for me to get around to watching the movie.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Because, you know,
I did enjoy it
to watch before the World Cup began, and the World Cup is now over, and this is a month-long affair. So we know that this movie has sat and collected dust in your apartment for some time before it went into the DVD player. So talk about your struggle.
Well, once, and then it went back to the library, and then it collected some more dust, and then I got it back, and then
right.
I watched it. So, one, it's not a short movie, and the back doesn't do it a great service, nor does the cover. Not that I judge every book or movie on its cover yet. I couldn't help but look at the back of this where, you know, it shows a giant samurai and a guy in a weird, like,
how are you going to hate on the giant samurai? Oh my
flying
god,
suit
is so freaking cool.
And a woman having her face stretched. It was just, yeah. So I was just like, I don't even know what I'm about to watch. And I still thought that about halfway through the movie. I was just like, what am I watching right now? But there were some really, really fantastic scenes throughout. I thought, you know, Robert De Niro is in this. His character is amazing.
And just not, I don't,
Well, actually, lots of other characters are also, I mean, fantastic. Ian Holm's character is really great.
As I was watching it this time, I was thinking that HVAC guys must love this movie, because the hero of the movie is basically a glorified, like, HVAC super commando guy.
Yeah.
Robert De Niro's character basically fixes ducts, central cooling and heating and other things, and he zips around on a zip line and is basically a ninja.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, and he has a fantastic mustache. I mean, he really could be Mario, the Mario that we deserved but never got.
It's funny because, you know, obviously Bob Hoskins plays the kind of villainous
HVAC
guy. And yes, and his costume is very, very, to me, reminiscent of Mario, because there's a lot of red in it, and he's got this little cap on and like suspenders and everything. And I was like, this is a much better Mario movie than the Mario movie that you played Mario in.
That's actually amazing. Yeah,
because the Mario movie is like a dystopia. Like they go through and there's like this dystopian dark world and everything. And and kind of the look of that movie is so similar to Brazil. I should probably shut up now, because anybody who hasn't seen Brazil is like, wait, this movie is anything
like Mario? You're comparing this to Mario Brothers right now? Yeah. No, actually, that's a really amazing comparison, though. And I wonder, you know, if Bob Hoskins was like, well, okay, I mean, I played a plumber before. How bad could this be? Well, you're about to find out. So we should probably get off of Super Mario Brothers, but...
Probably.
So... Jared, you did pick this movie. Tell me about why you picked it, why you've been thinking about it, why you wanted to watch it again, and why you wanted to share it.
Right, well, I feel like I've said this probably before, but, you know, one of the main reasons why I pick any movie to talk about here, or at least a large reason, is that it's a movie that I've been looking for an excuse to watch again.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this one several years ago and really liked it. It's probably my favorite Terry Gilliam movie, although I haven't seen Time Bandits, shockingly, which is supposed to be really, really good. He made, you know, I don't know if you saw this anywhere, when you were doing any reading on this, but he made what's considered to be a loose trilogy of films.
Yeah, and this is the second of three.
And this is the middle chapter. So it's kind of like, one of them is the story is kind of from a child's perspective, that's Time Bandits, and there's this one, which is more of a midlife crisis kind of story, and then there's the older man story, which is The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is also really, really great. I love that one, too.
Are there any actors that are in all of these, like, I don't know, or sort of a running gag?
Well, like I said, I haven't seen Time Bandits, and the movies are so, so disconnected from each other that I would have to watch them probably back-to-back to really know. It's been so long since I've seen The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I mean, they all have some insane, surreal stuff going on. If I remember correctly, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen has Uma Thurman in it. It has Robin Williams in it. They aren't the main characters. These are kind of bit roles. But
right.
It has some heavy-ish hitters.
Well, if they're half as good as Jim Broadbent's role in Brazil, then, well, score.
They're definitely... I would almost say, well, we shouldn't get off on Baron Munchausen, but it's a bit more fantastical and surreal than this movie is, in a different way, because it's him kind of telling stories about his adventures, and in kind of Big Fish kind of fashion. A lot of them are just wild and crazy. But anyway, I really like this movie. I like the performances in it, and I like just the whole style of the world that's created and everything, and really, so that's the conversation that I guess I wanted to have, just like exploring the world that this movie creates, because it does create its own kind of world. It's not a world you would want to live in, but it's a world that I find extremely fun to watch.
Yeah, I think what stood out to me is that it's both, I know that we're watching this, 29 years after it was made, but,
Is that right? That is right.
29.
Yes,
yeah,
of course, that's right. Yes,
almost
right.
30
almost
years.
Almost 30 years. Right.
So actually, I guess it would be 30 years probably since it's been made, but it hasn't been out that long.
Because it took so long to release.
Long.
Yes, right.
Right. And we can talk about that later, but I have totally lost my train of thought.
Well, it's been so
oh,
long
yes.
time since it was released.
It's been so long, and yet it's clearly supposed to be futuristic, and it is futuristic in a lot of ways, and yet even at the time, I know that the point was certainly, even in this futuristic world where, you know, all of, you know, very much the world has gone this way, and that we're desperately seeking convenience at any and all costs, and yet all these things that are supposed to be making people's lives more convenient are actually all garbage, you know, they're actually making people's lives a lot harder, if anything.
Well,
and none of them
you know,
are
we had this conversation a little bit, and the more I've thought about it, the more convinced I am. Like, you know, we talked about, and when the movie first came out, like, almost every reviewer used the word futuristic at some point in their review. But even at the time, and all the more so now, I don't find anything remotely futuristic about this movie, honestly. Like... Obviously, everything that's happening in the movie, or all, kind of the aesthetic of the movie, is very retro. They're going for like a kind of a 40s look to like the costumes and the technology, even though it's, you know, doing things that weren't available in the 1940s. But it feels like it's what someone in the 1940s would have imagined the future looking like, even though it was made in the 1980s. And I obviously think that was deliberate. And also. You know,
like we took
as
a really dark
you.
Path after 1945.
Right. Nothing works correctly, et cetera, et cetera. The technology, like, you know, it struck me even more this time than it had the first time I saw it, where the technology is just so hilariously awkward to use, and they have all these modern conveniences, but none of them work quite right. There's this sequence when... Jonathan Pryce plays the main character, Sam Lowry, when he's waking up late and he's got all of his automated stuff running to get him going, and it makes him toast and it makes him coffee, but then it dumps his coffee onto his toast. And just these conveniences are not that convenient even when they work correctly, which they usually don't. And you look at like the way their phones work, all of their phones, even the phones that are in their houses,
terrible.
work like switchboards, like you see old-timey things where you have these operators sitting in front of these massive boards where you plug things in, and there are a couple scenes where he's trying to answer the phone, and he has to,
he
like, unplug one cord into one other... There's, you know, seven or eight cords dangling out of it. It looks like the back of my VCR.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to compare it to. It looks, I mean, like the most inconvenient system ever.
Right. You know, and,
like,
and obviously...
gotta plug in the office line.
there's the just these hideous ducts that run around through everything and every building all over the place. And it's never quite clear all of the things that these ducts are meant to accomplish, but they just kind of stand for just kind of a generic, like, technological thing that's bulky and ugly and in the way. And there are several scenes where you can see, especially when they're in this really nice restaurant, you can see that the decorators have made an effort to kind of make them look nice and like they fit in with the aesthetic of the rest of the restaurant, and they just don't, because they're just huge, hideous ducts emerging from the center of the room and coiling around every which way, like big, ugly snakes. So the ducts, obviously there's a heating element and a cooling element, but there are also ducts that carry papers throughout this giant bureaucracy. That's another thing, you know, where you have this everything's being filled out in triplicate and quadruplicate and stamped and double stamped, and you've got automated typewriters typing things up and printing things out, and people sitting at desks typing things and sending papers everywhere.
I mean, it's actually, you know, in the midst of all of this automation that the catalyst of our film's events takes place. You know, there's a clerical error due to an annoying fly, and the wrong man is...
Yes, a guy in an office kills a bug that's bothering him. It drops into a typewriter, which causes a warrant for the arrest of Mr. Tuttle to instead be issued for the arrest of Mr. Buttle, thus launching a comic series of ridiculous bureaucratic mishaps. At least it would be comic if it weren't so horrible what is happening to him. Because
Mr.
he ends
Buttle
up tortured to death. Yes, Mr. Buttle ends up tortured to death because they didn't know about his heart condition because they thought he was Mr. Tuttle, et cetera,
and then everybody's trying to hand off, you know, the resulting paperwork to another department.
Right, whose fault was this? Well, it's their fault and that fault. Yes, because an error is a terrible thing, even though you imagine that they must happen all the time. Well, that you know they happen all the time because this bureaucracy is enormous and just the most grossly inefficient, incompetent system you've ever seen.
Yeah.
The only reason that it continues to work is because it's so fantastically huge. It just kind of stumbles along under its own inertia, I guess.
Well, and there's this whole... running throughout, there's a terrorist movement that's trying to take the government down. And Sam Lowry is trying, you know, in the midst of all this, like, he ends up becoming part of the resistance, sort of. But even
very
to
sort
almost,
of.
almost, yeah, almost to the very end, he still is convinced that the government is absolutely necessary, if nothing else, to keep these terrorists at bay.
Right. So this would probably be a good time for us to fire off the spoiler klaxons. Just so you know,
right,
spoilers
here.
From here on out.
Yep.
What was I going to say? Oh, yes. So we should probably at least briefly discuss the George Orwell 1984 connection. Just because it would be hard for anyone... I can't imagine anyone watching this who knows anything about Orwell in 1984, especially with this movie coming out in 1985 as well, and not kind of make that connection of between this and the ultimate dystopia that is 1984.
It is pretty similar, but, I mean, there is no Big Brother character.
Well...
Or figurehead.
There is. There's no Big Brother character in... Like, it's basically like they are being watched. Everything they do is kind of being watched. But that is the big difference, I think, between Orwell's 1984 and this movie. That Orwell was warning us about where things might go and about kind of a possible terrible dark future. Whereas this movie, the government is sinister. But, as we were saying, just completely, bumblingly, outrageously incompetent, where it's not in 1984.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not efficient. So it's a little bit less sinister because, although...
Or more sinister,
I don't know,
depending on how you
almost
look at
more,
it.
Right, I mean, it's kind of... Actually, yeah, let me take that back because, I mean, probably the best characterization of evil that I've ever read is... In Paralandra, where evil is,
C.S. Lewis
book. Incredibly, yeah, it is almost childlike in its evil, but all the more terrifying for that.
Right. So you know, it's So that's the 1984 connection, I guess, and the contrast really. I was talking earlier about the heroic HVAC character played by Robert De Niro, who, of course, is Mr. Tuttle, FYI. The Mr. Tuttle
Not
that
Tuttle.
Was supposed to be arrested, yes. I should mention, you know, I called him heroic. He's, I would say, the closest thing to a hero in this movie. Sam Lowry's character, it didn't strike me before, as much as it did this time, how... completely unheroic he is in every way. He literally doesn't do a single selfless thing in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Like everything he does is completely self-centered and selfish. His entire goal to begin with, obviously, is to avoid being noticed, and not to be promoted up through the ranks, and just kind of to hide and be lazy and mediocre and go about his business quietly. And the only reason he decides to change that is because he sees this woman who looks just like the woman he's been dreaming about. And then he starts doing all kinds of really creepy and terrible things, basically, to get to be in a position to be in contact with her. And then he does all kinds of terrible, terrible things to stay in contact with her. Like, he just, like, that's what gets him in trouble with the government, that he wants to get laid. that's what he decides to do, and that's what he pursues. And so he's just kind of this, I don't know, he's a really skeezy character, actually.
Yeah, and he actually, I mean, I think he tells himself that it's...
He does some really noble-seeming things.
Yeah, but it's really for his own, I mean...
His motivations are completely...
Clearly selfish. And, I mean, doesn't turn out well for anyone involved.
Right. Yeah, so, but the thing about his character, I think, that makes that, I don't know, what makes this particularly interesting to me is just the culture of the movie, of the people in the movie, and how he's really a part of that culture, where basically this is a society that, places no value whatsoever on human life, and you see that in the government and the actions of the government, you see that in the terrorists and the way that they, you know, they're ostensibly the good guys, the rebels, because they're battling the system, but they basically go around bombing completely innocent people, because they come from a society that doesn't value human lives. And, you know, all of the people that Sam Lowry interacts with, his family, his mother and his mother's friends, and he himself, you know, there's the scene where they're in the restaurant and a terrorist bomb goes off over in the corner, and basically every part of the restaurant where people aren't dying and, you know, crawling around wounded just kind of goes back to eating, including them, and is mostly just kind of annoyed at the inconvenience of the noise and the dust and everything.
You know, the waiter comes up and apologizes profusely. Oh, yo, this never happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's probably the most really disturbing thing about... To me, this is the most disturbing thing about the thing about this movie is how little the people in the society care about anyone other than themselves. And it does map pretty closely to the kind of first world problems society that we... sometimes encounter ourselves today.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that and, you know, just the kind of absurdity of some of the technology. There's, oh, I'm trying to think, what other things
I wanted to like point out, just in, you know, the utter disregard for human life, and, I mean, just for what we, I don't know, might refer to as just plain human decency. We meet one of Sam's old friends, Jack, early on in the film, and we just see him, you know, disappear into an office building after some awkward, you know, an awkward exchange between the two of them. And
which Sam is probably one of my favorite. Like, how are the twins? Right. Oh, triplets. Oh, how time flies.
As if, right. Well, Sam realizes later in the film that he actually needs Jack, so he goes on to see him, and this is probably my favorite.
No, he doesn't go to see him. He goes to see someone, and like that.
To realize that it's Jack. Well,
right, because he goes to see this guy's number. Well, we already fired off the spoilers.
Right. So he goes in to see a man who turns out to be a torturer. And he doesn't know it when he walks into the office because, you know, he just walks in. His receptionist is sitting there typing away with headphones. And he's told to wait. He looks over just to see what she might be typing. And it, you know, it looks like such an ordinary scene. But
she's not a receptionist. She's a transcript keeper.
Yeah, and she's typing up the notes of the torture session going on. In the next room, which is...
And it's just a lot of, oh, ow, oh, ow, ah, ah!
please don't, please don't, no.
Stop.
You know, and then, you know, she lifts up her headphones at one point, you know, to see what he wants. And, you know, you can hear the guy screaming. And then he ends up going, you know, being ushered into the guy's office. And, you know, it's literally right next door to this torture chamber. And what do we see but, you know, the torturer's daughter playing with toys on the floor.
Because it's bring your daughter to work
right
day
there.
Or whatever.
Because so
he comes
awful.
In and he's washing the blood off of his hands. Yes.
And, yeah.
It is
taking essentially like, you know, a butcher's like coat
smock
off,
or whatever. Yeah.
Just like, yeah. Smock. Yeah. Covered in blood.
It is simultaneously horrifying and hilarious.
Yeah.
Which is something this movie does very well. And something.
Is that characteristic of Terry Gilliam films? Cause I guess I haven't, I don't know. I wouldn't know. I haven't seen enough of him.
I don't know if I would say characteristic, but it's certainly not unusual to have outrageously grotesque things in a very tongue-in-cheek sort of tone. Yes, I would say. but, you know, I think one of the things that makes this movie really great, and, you know, we've already talked about this a little bit, but just the fact that Sam Lowry, when he reads the transcript and he hears the thing and then he sees his friend with the blood and everything, like, none of that shocks him. He doesn't register any surprise or horror or shock at any of these things, because they aren't a surprise to him. And he's the audience surrogate, because he's the protagonist, and so I think in a lesser movie, he would be expressing the emotions that we're feeling, but he doesn't, because he's in this world, and he's part of this world, and this is not unusual or bizarre or horrible to him. It's just what it is. I like that.
He's grown used to it.
Well, he, yeah.
Well, if
it just,
he
it's
ever
just
knew
part of his
different.
World. Yes, exactly. A couple of the things that the movie skewers satirically about contemporary society is obviously the mania for plastic surgery and looking younger than one is. His mother and his mother's best friend go to competing doctors for skin treatments and surgery and things like that. His mother's doctor, Dr. Jaffe, is played by Jim Broadbent. Yes. And in the first scene that we see her in, he's like pulling her face out, stretching it, pinning it back with clothespins and like stretching shrink wrap across it and all of these ridiculous things. His mother's best friend is being treated with some kind of acid or something, and every time we see her, she looks worse and worse. She's got more bandages, and she's like, oh yes, there's just been some complications.
It's going to get better.
any day now, I'll be... it's amazing.
But even, you know, she's not getting what she's going for, but she's not giving up hope because, you know, what she's motivated by is worth, you know, everything that she's going through, at least in her mind.
And she trusts her doctor, who's obviously a total quack, when he tells her, well, you know, this is, you know, we'll have this fixed in a jiffy. Don't worry. This is completely normal. Your face is falling off.
But on the other hand, you know, the main character's mom, she actually is seeing results, but as we learn by the end of the film, the results are, well, not only short-lived, but actually end up being lethal to her, end up killing her. Although, is that part of a dream sequence?
No.
Like, is that actually...
Okay, you're thinking of the part that's part of the dream sequence, and isn't that's the funeral for her mother's friend.
Oh, I thought that was for her.
No, and it is part of the dream sequence, but there are things that happen in the dream sequence at the end that I feel like are likely also
we're
happening
supposed
in
to
real
take...
life.
Yeah.
But anyway, be that as it may. The other thing, well, and of course, one of my favorite things that I told you about, there's always something going on in the background of this movie, even if it's not happening in the part of the screen that you're supposed to be focused on. So when he goes to that party and he meets his torturer friend Jack's wife again, and Jack is like asking him if he notices the difference in his wife, and there's some mix up over because she went to see the plastic surgeon, and there's some mix up. He thinks that Jack must be talking about her breasts, but he's talking about her ears, and this awkward little exchange. But so she's had her ears fixed by Dr. Jaffe, and then they go off to a side of the room while he stays and talks to somebody else, and you see Dr. Jaffe kind of wander up behind the woman and start poking at her ear as he leans creepily over her shoulder.
It's like admiring his handiwork.
Right, exactly. So it'd be really easy to miss if you weren't watching for it. And there's just stuff like that scattered all throughout this movie. The other thing that the movie, I think, skewers pretty effectively is just, like, this absurd level of commercialism. And it does this in a variety of different ways, usually in kind of just throwaway lines and throwaway images, like... there's a scene where the camera is panning past a department store Santa Claus, and there's a kid sitting in his lap talking about how he wants his first credit card for Christmas. Start him young. There's the scene where they're driving down a long highway, and you can't see anything outside of the highway because it's just lined completely all the way down with billboards on both sides of the highway. But then as the camera pulls back, you realize that there's nothing to see anyway because the land on either side is completely denuded of all life as far as the eye can see because
desolate.
Of industrial waste. Yes.
Yeah.
So some pretty strong statements about stuff that we recognize in our world.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, see more rather than less since 1985, probably.
Probably.
At least, I don't know.
It's not the sort of thing that tends to go backwards much.
Right. So, Jared, I know that this film went through a whole lot in the post-production phase and prior to its release. So, run me through, like, why did it go through all the troubles it did?
Well, he released the film in Europe in some form or another, probably on the festival circuit. I don't really know.
Everything that he intended was in there.
Right. So I say it did quite well. It was well received by the audiences that saw it. I don't know how big of a run that it was having or whatever. But when he brought it back to be released in the U.S., the studio obviously thought that it wasn't remotely marketable or commercial or going to make any money. So they basically took editing rights away from him and chopped it up into like an hour and a half version, which is about 45 minutes shorter than the version that we have. So they chopped it into an hour and a half version called the Love Conquers All cut, which, you know, I obviously don't know how... what all they did to it, but it had a happy ending, a happy romantic ending.
Based on the cut that I saw, that cut sounds awful.
It sounds awful and completely at odds with the vision of the finished film as we have it now.
Sure.
So Gilliam, you know, I don't know if he would have rolled over and taken this otherwise, but he had the success in Europe to go off of, so he decided to fight them on it, and he ended up showing the movie in a few limited invitation screenings to key people, and ultimately, I believe it was the L.A. Critics Society, I don't know their name, basically ended up giving it all of their highest awards for the year. They gave it Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay, and kind of on the strength of those kinds of responses, he was able to get a compromise cut with, you know, just a few minutes shaved off, released, and, you know, what I see now, what I watched was the director's cut with the extra few minutes added back on. I don't know if that was the one you watched or not.
Yeah, I don't think so, actually.
But either way, you know, even the compromise cut stayed true to how he wanted the movie to end and so on and so forth. I don't know if it just cut some of the darker bits or what they did to make it more commercial. Whatever they did, it didn't work because the movie didn't actually do that well in American theaters. But it quickly became kind of a cult classic, and that's kind of the status that it enjoys today, and deservedly so, I would say, because it is not mainstream, but it is, I would say, a masterpiece. So, yeah, for what it's worth.
I feel like crickets on my end. I mean, it was, honestly, like, I liked parts of it, and I wanted to talk about pieces of it, but again,
well, tell me about the parts that you didn't feel that way about. Like, what? Because to me, it's great satire. There's so much humor in the movie and so much you know, drama and just amazing production design throughout. Like, I don't even know, like, there's the scene in the torture room that they filmed inside of, like, a abandoned nuclear, whatever they call those giant things, like...
Like silo?
Yeah. And it's just, they have these massive, ridiculous, amazing sets that are just like, where did you even find this location? how is what I'm seeing on the screen even real? Yeah, I don't know.
I just didn't find it very enjoyable. There were, especially like the, I know what he was going for with the dream sequences, but it was just like,
which we haven't even talked about yet.
Watching. Yeah, which, so Sam will either wake up from these dreams throughout the movie, or he'll, you know, be standing there having a conversation with someone and then, you know, sort of go into a trance and have visions of himself, you know, flying or...
So you say, what am I even watching? I say, it looks awesome. I don't even care what I'm watching. Like, he's wearing this awesome, like, suit of armor, and he's got these, like, angel wings, and he's flying around.
I don't think it's held up very well.
Huge... Well, in terms of the special effects, you mean? But because
yeah.
it's so,
I mean,
obviously
time,
a dream sequence, it doesn't even matter, because it's not supposed to look real. And that's something that Gilliam does often, I think, with a lot of his things. Like, he has better effects at his disposal now than he did to begin with, but I don't think he tries really any harder to make it look hyper-realistic, because that's not the point.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that I wish that, like, you know, why didn't they wait a few years for some better special effects or anything
visually
like that? It's just
stunning, even though it doesn't look remotely like he's really flying, because it's not supposed to look like he's really flying. But I still, you know, I was impressed by the fight scene between him and the samurai. Like, the
really?
Way they cut it together, the samurai looks so huge. And I don't know exactly what trickery
was
done to make it look so big and still be able to move kind of normally and everything. And, you know, I love, like, the jets of flame that shoot out of it whenever he wounds it.
Right.
I thought that was really cool. I don't know, I and, you know,
I mean,
all of the, like, the really, really creepy, like, people with the baby masks and the hunchbacks and everything, really freaky, and I like that. I like the way that the dreams kind of show the horrible reality of his world, of his real life, kind of intruding even on his fantasies as the movie goes on, where, you know, kind of, even though he lives in this society that completely devalues human life, and he couldn't care less about Buttle or anything that's going on, somewhere in his subconscious,
he can't
it's
help
bothering
it.
Him. He's got this guilty conscience about it, and it's just, it starts to emerge more and more violently as the movie goes on. And it's screwing up his real life. It's also screwing up his fantasy life. He's not just a hero saving a girl anymore. He's now got, like, these horrible monsters clawing at him and asking, "What did they do with the body?" And he can't escape it even just dreaming anymore like he used to.
I mean, I know that this movie is considered a masterpiece by many and is held in wide regard as clearly like a cult classic, but the word that comes to mind, honestly, is indulgent. Like, I recognize this
well,
director
and that's
had
something
a vision.
People who
and,
appreciate it say he went
right.
overboard.
He just, like, kind of threw everything up there, and I know, like, you know, obviously he's very attached to his material and didn't want to cut much, but if I saw, like, the theatrical cut, I just, like, I don't know. What more did he add? It's kind of like when I went to see The Hobbit, where I was just like, I mean, what's the extended edition
really?
Going to look like? Okay, yeah, you're right. That's an unfair comparison. Yet, indulgent is still the word that comes
to mind. The Hobbit
to mind.
Is the work of a hack.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not saying it's the same level, but...
No, I understand the analogy you're making. You know, but the definition of a cult classic to me is... I mean, it's not just that it's a classic, it's also that it has kind of this cult following, and one thing about a cult is...
Oh, it deserves its standing in
right,
that place.
But what I'm saying is, one thing about a cult is that not everybody's in it.
Like, right, yeah.
It's this small group of people that reveres the movie, that maybe not everyone totally gets, and maybe there's a good reason why not everyone gets it, because maybe there's not as much to get as the people who love it think there is. I don't know. But, you know, Terry Gilliam's there are a lot of self-indulgent directors out there, but Gilliam's brand of self-indulgence doesn't really bother me that much.
You're like, show me more!
I guess, more of your surrealistic, bizarre, completely out of, like, you know, it's not more stuff blowing up bigger, and it's not more ninja elf fight scenes. Like,
if you want explosions, this movie has them.
Occasionally, yes, it does have some pretty spectacular. But they're not, yeah, they're not.
Yeah, like, but they're not like, yeah, you don't watch this movie for the explosions. Just want to point that out there also.
That there are things blowing up occasionally, yes, fair enough.
Yeah. I do love, actually, one of my favorite things about the movie is the ending, that it's sort of, it totally toys with you. I mean, I knew it was happening.
It's the occurrence
at Owl
Creek.
I'm glad that it happened.
Ending. That's yeah. Kind of the classic example. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I was like, yeah, I'm going to pretend like I know what that is. Nope.
No, because this is something that shows up a lot. It's a short story that shows up a lot in English classes. Basically, it's set during the Civil War, and this guy is captured by, I think it's the Union Army, and they're going to hang him off of a bridge, and as he falls with the noose around his neck, the rope snaps, and lands in the water, and he swims away, even though they're firing at him from the bridge, and he goes through all of this stuff and gets back home, and right as he's arriving home, back to his wife again, suddenly he hits the end of the rope and his neck snaps, and like everything that happened in between was just this elaborate fantasy he had in the moment before his actual death.
And it was made
into a fairly famous short film that was released as a Twilight Zone episode, actually, in the 60s. But anyway, so that's kind of the classic example of this dream sequence ending that actually pulls the rug out from under you, and the happy thing that you see happening isn't actually happening. It's just the character fantasizing his way out of something horrible that's happening.
Oh, and speaking of the character's fantasy, so we've spoken about how Sam has been fixated on this woman, and throughout the film, before he even meets her, I mean, he's dreaming about this woman that really, I mean, at least in his dreams, makes him a hero by just the simple act of saving her.
And she's this totally passive figure in his dreams.
Right.
I don't know if that's where you're going with this. You go ahead and make your point.
Yeah, she's quite the opposite in real life.
And it really messes with his fantasy.
yeah. But I mean, he, you know, they do end up having a night together. But I mean, the whole thing
maybe
is a fantasy. It's, probably. The whole thing is a fantasy, though, because at the end of the day, it's actually really creepy. You know, they end up like sleeping together in his mom's home. She's like in a nightgown, which I assume like it's not hers. It's probably his mom's. She's wearing a wig that you know looks like it actually pretty closely matches her appearance the way that she is in his dreams.
Right.
But
she
then
becomes,
of course,
his dream girl.
Yeah, and then he wakes up and
for
finds
one night,
you know, the wig
right
there, and is a little bit confused about it for a second. The whole thing just sort of falls apart from there.
Right. But yeah, his entire attitude towards her when he finally meets her is, let me save you. And she's like, go away. Like, is like throwing him out of her truck and trying to run him over. And basically, like, you know, she's not the passive damsel in distress that he was expecting. She's tougher than he is.
Yeah, by far. He's a major wimp. Well, also, I mean, on top of that, I mean, kind of a snake, as we...
Well, yeah, I mean, he's a mid-level bureaucrat. He's exactly what you would expect a mid-level bureaucrat to be.
Right.
He has all of those qualities that you would expect. Well, I mentioned, speaking of, you know, the scene where they wake up in bed together. Of course, then the SWAT team busts in, and that's like the second or third time this has happened. And I thought it was funny when I was reading some stuff about this movie, how at the time when this movie came out, that wasn't like a cliche, like where the SWAT team like busts in coming from every direction. It was really kind of this comedically over-the-top thing in this movie where you've got SWAT guys coming in the windows and through the ceiling and the doors and like just crashing in from all sides to a ridiculous degree to deal with essentially people who aren't really violent or really going to fight back that effectively or anything. But one of the things that I love about the scene following that where he's in the truck and he's been arrested and everything, and he's like trying to figure out where she is in the truck, and the two guards that are sitting there are kind of having this kind of jovial conversation, and then they tell him he needs to sit down, he doesn't, and one of them stands up and kind of knocks him unconscious. That, and, you know, everything, like, there's so much, like, fascism, what we would call fascism going on in this movie. There was, just, like, people, like, forcing people to do things and just being really, like, over, like, this totalitarian kind of state. But everyone's so friendly and nice about it all the time. Like, sometimes it's this kind of, it's obviously kind of this veneer of friendliness that's masking kind of some other emotions underneath. But they're still, like, they're polite about it. There's no, even police brutality is done with this kind of sorry old chap kind of smile on the face about it. And it's just really weird and kind of off-putting and creepy.
I mean, you noted that, I mean, it is part of, like, the buffoonery of this bureaucracy. I mean, and like you said, I don't know if it makes them more sinister or less.
Oh, definitely more. Definitely more sinister. Because, yeah, like, the guy who, I don't know, you're scared of anyone who's going to come after you to kill you or torture you or whatever, but if they're doing it with this big grin on their face, there's just, like, this weird inhumanity to that that is far more horrifying.
Right. Right.
It's like I mean, evil that just doesn't even remotely recognize that it's evil.
Has no conscience and, yeah, isn't going to recognize reason, at least just, not the way that we see it.
A terrifying vision. I did also want to mention an exchange, speaking of, I know we're jumping around here a bit, but contemporary connections. I think this is a connection that I make more now than, that has more political relevance now than had at the time that this movie was released, is when they're in the truck. He's in the truck with the girl heading into town. He's just been promoted to information retrieval, and she knows he's in information retrieval. The only reason he went to information retrieval was so he could retrieve information about her. But we find out once he's in information retrieval that that's basically what they call the Ministry of Torture. They're retrieving information from torture victims. But she asks him, doesn't it bother you the sort of things you do at information retrieval? And he responds, I suppose you'd rather have terrorists. And that's exactly the kind of attitude that we've seen with kind of the growing security state in the United States. With the TSA and all of their ridiculous kind of abuses and incompetence that happens with them every now and then, like, the response to any kind of criticism of them and of what they do tends to be, well, at least we don't have terrorists, right? Like anything, any kind of excess is okay to stop that happening. And it doesn't even matter that what they're doing doesn't actually stop or prevent terrorism in any way. Like, that doesn't even seem to be part of the conversation. Anyway, I just thought that was funny and timely now in a way that it wasn't before.
Although I guess I wonder if it was timely then, maybe not for the U.S., but in the U.K. it would have been.
I don't know. Was there a lot of terrorism in the U.K. in the mid-1980s?
Actually, I don't know the timeline, but I would have thought
I guess that you've got the Cold War going on, and there's probably some other stuff. So,
you're probably the IRA.
Right, obviously that too, yes. I'm sure it wasn't like just him being super prescient about the future. I'm sure there was something that mapped to, but
But it does. Yeah. You're right. Like it does fit very well into the conversation today, if that conversation is happening.
Yes. Yes. Well, and the other thing that I love about the bureaucracy, about the way the bureaucracy is portrayed in this movie is, you know, like the scene where he is having that major meltdown with his duct system, and he calls Central Services, which is the name for the government, and he gets this very automated sounding voice that goes through this long, like, "We're sorry, Central Services can no longer answer calls between this hour and this hour, and blah 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 blah, and please do this and please do that." And then at the very end of this rigmarole, the voice is like, "This has not been a recording." Like, this is an actual person on the other end of the line who's picking up the phone and answering him and saying, "Sorry, we can't accept calls right now." And, like, is going on in this whole, like, very recorded-sounding spiel. And that's just so exemplary of the waste and incompetence and silliness of the entire system. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, despite his protestations and his attempts to get the voice's attention.
Exactly. She just kind of carries on as though she were a recording, even though she has declared that she isn't.
Yeah.
Classic. Classic.
So, in closing, I've said more than enough about this film, but you picked this movie, and I do think that, like, I'm glad that I watched it, and, like, with any cult film that I've seen, like, I appreciate it. I am able to appreciate it, and I recognize why it has the status that it has. But how do you want to close this out here?
Well, we should probably close by talking about the title of the movie.
Yeah, which, by the way,
like, why is this called Brazil? Because there's no reference to Brazil anywhere in the movie. They don't go to Brazil. They don't talk about going to Brazil. They've never been to Brazil.
As far as we know, it doesn't exist anymore.
As far as we know, there is no Brazil anywhere in the world at this point. We don't know where they are in the world, but Brazil doesn't seem to be part of it. So why, in the name of all that is holy, is this movie called Brazil? It's named after this song from the 1930s mm-hmm. called Brazil that plays almost constantly throughout the soundtrack of the movie. And it's this very kind of relaxed, smooth, upbeat sort of song.
Well, actually, we're going to go ahead and play it right now.
Well, yeah, we'll let Brazil play us out as we talk. But kind of the lyrics of the song refer to, you know, a people who were having kind of a romantic tryst in Brazil, and just kind of, it has this kind of escapist, happy feel that is at odds with the movie, but that makes sense in terms of kind of the escape that he wants to have but can never have it. And I guess the escape that he ultimately gets through kind of his own imagination, where he kind of goes insane and retreats into himself and is lost to the outside world, but he has escaped to this fantasy land.
The only place where okay, he ever, you know, is able to have the kind of impact on the world around him that he wishes he were able to make, really.
Yes, agreed. So, Brazil, ladies and gentlemen. Love it. Oh, yeah, I've been humming that obsessively on and off for days.
Well, as it's playing here, I'm sure that that's the best way to leave people. So go after, you know, as you're humming this, just let that be a reminder. Go find it, watch it, and let us know what you think.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us. This has been Movie Goings, and we will see you next time.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Brazil.
Sorry, buddy. Show's over.